This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Man, you know what I haven't done in a really long time? Is listen to myself talk into a microphone. But hey, I hear you guys. I have a ton of people in my DMs right now asking me about my opinion on the new dietary guidelines for Americans. And I can't think of a better way to come out of podcast retirement. It was actually not supposed to be a retirement, but hey, life happens and I'm working on it, okay? But what better way to break out my podcast equipment to give my opinions on this topic? Because I started to write like an Instagram carousel that I was going to upload tomorrow, but my thoughts were just too long. So it has to be in audio form. And I was going to do a video. And then I was like, that's just way too long. So here we are. We're doing a podcast and it's going to be a special episode. I have been reading other people's opinions. I have been reading the actual guidelines. I've gone through the 418 page appendix to make sure that I am getting all of my data gathered before I give my opinion. Because yeah, I could probably give a very emotionally charged opinion based on just who gave this guideline. But you know what? That's not my job as a nutritional educator. I'm here to give you facts and what you should look for and what my concerns are as a registered dietitian. So without further ado, here are my opinions and my thoughts on the new dietary guidelines that were just announced. Caveat, this is my first DGA as a dietitian. The other ones were released in 2020. They are released every 5 years. I was a dietetic intern when the other ones were released, so I did not feel like I held enough power to give my opinion. So this is very exciting for me as well, and I want to do this well and not just come at it like as a hothead or something. I want to be a good, effective nutrition communicator. So here we go. To be honest, I was expecting them to be worse. That's a personal opinion. We're starting off really strong, but you know what I mean. I was expecting them to be a lot worse for the amount of discourse that has been in the scientific community in the last year or so, okay? But upon reading them, some of it is good. Some of it I agree with. It's fine. I am neutral about a lot of it. However, some of it I am skeptical. So first, let's go over the good. All right, the good. It highlights and encourages the importance of nutrient-dense foods like fruits, vegetables, whole grains, dairy, and quote-unquote healthy fats. I'm going to put an asterisk right there, and that's going to be a caveat. Overall recommendation of 5 servings of fruits and vegetables. We love that. It actually was 2.5 cups of vegetables in the last guidelines, and now they've bumped it up to 3. So, hey, we love an increase of vegetables. That is not an issue with me whatsoever. Drinking about 2 to 3 cups of milk. Love my dairy and calcium. Choosing whole grains. Love that. And focus on high protein. Objectively good. Objectively good. Love. It encourages limiting added sugars and saturated fats. Caveat number 2 that I will come back to this, but objectively good on those 2. There is an increased protein recommendation intake from 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight to 1.2 to 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight. Caveat number 3, I believe. I don't have an issue with this. I am a huge fiend for protein as well, but there's a lot of nuance and conversation to that as well. But other than that, those are the overall guidelines that we're getting, right? It's a, if you click on it, realfood.gov, it is a 10-page document that was definitely meant for the general public. It was not for healthcare professionals because it's very, it's meant for the general public, if you know what I mean. They're not revolutionary. Most of the new guidance, quote unquote, is being repackaged of advice we've been saying for years. It's not nutritional breakthrough, if you know what I mean. So at the very basis of it all, the whole conversation, most of the guidelines are fine. But if we want to go into a deeper level, which is why I'm literally recording this, there's very much concerns that I have as a dietitian. So let's get into those now. Number one, we haven't used the food pyramid in 15 years. We have not used it in 15 years. It is confusing to the general public. And the MyPlate graphic was far easier coming from the teaching side. It was far easier to teach and provide examples to patients and clients. But now with this upside down pyramid, I fear the confusion will stem from it because this pyramid would have you think, if you're just looking at it at face value, it would have you think that you need to severely limit your whole grains, right? Since they're at the bottom, they're the smallest item shown. However, if you go through the actual 10-page document, it recommends 2 to 4 servings of whole grains per day, which is good. We want that. That is a very normal amount. But if you're looking at the depiction of it, it's not accurately portrayed with the amount shown in the pyramid. So at face value, I'm nervous about confusion from the general public because if someone is lacking nutritional education background and they look at this graphic and they're like, oh, well, I clearly need to eat 10 pounds of steak and just have one piece of bread during the entire day. That just doesn't sit right with me. And it's not the best graphic to use for the general public. That is, again, just a personal opinion, but a personal opinion rooted in having teaching these guidelines. This really isn't a concern, but it's just a funny thing. If you read the guidelines, it says the war on protein is over. Friend, I don't know where you're living at, but I don't necessarily deem it a war on protein because I can get protein popcorn and protein Pop-Tarts at my grocery store. I don't believe protein has ever been at war, but that's just that again is another personal opinion, and I'm not doing a really good job at not saying it, but it was just funny to read in an official release to say the war on protein is over. Because what? Another concern of mine is the portion in the document that mentions limiting added sugar. Let me be very clear. I do love the recommendation of limiting your added sugar because added sugar can contribute to a plethora of health issues. I understand that. However, the guidelines are unclear at best, with no really clear direction other than just to quote unquote avoid, unless you want to go through the 418-page appendix, which doesn't, the general public doesn't have a lot of time for. So I know it's my job as a nutritional educator to disperse this information. However, if you're just looking at the DGAs, you are very confused other than just to completely restrict added sugar, which we all know the number one predictor of binging is restriction. So I did not love the ambiguity of this section, as well as if you get into the population part of the document, it says it recommends that children avoid added sugars until they're 10 years old. Now, I don't know about you, but that is not realistic for an average person. That it's just not realistic. Also, how sad of a life to not have sugar in your birthday cake when you're like 5. Okay, cool. The first 2 years of life, I'm pretty, lenient on that as a mom myself, but that's a personal decision and I'm not loading her with sugar, but whatever. Anyway, I'm not getting into that. But say you're 6 years old and you can't have a cookie cake. Very on par for me to talk about cake on this podcast. However, I just am appalled kind of at recommending that children should just avoid all added sugars until 10 years old. I think it's unrealistic. And I think people would do better with more distinct guidelines rather than just saying, nope, you can't have it, because that's just going to make it all the more desirable at the end of the day. Any parent would know that. So did not love that portion as well. In the same breath of added sugars and things alike, the DGAs now recommend avoiding highly processed foods, which is pretty notable that they're not using the term ultra-processed foods. I think that's just an interesting little tidbit, mostly because having a scientific definition of like junk food, ultra-processed food, and things like that is really hard. This is just the newest attempt. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. When you hear highly processed or something, everyone immediately thinks, you know, Pop-Tarts, Twinkies, everything. But this definition also fits with like almond and oat milk lattes, canned beans and veggies, yogurt, granolas, trail mixes, protein shakes. The things that are a lot of the times a bridge when people are like, hey, I really need this nutrition. I'm going to get it quickly in this protein bar, or protein shake or something. And yes, it's not like the number one recommendation to consume. But, you know, if you're in the middle of the day and you don't have time to cook a 5-course filet mignon or a salmon filet, then yeah, it's perfectly fine. So it's again, another ambiguity error in these guidelines, because you're saying just limit it altogether, when in reality, it is used as a tool a lot of the times in most Americans' home for nutritional purposes. Now, this next part is very much my biggest concern, or one of the biggest concerns that I have with these new DGAs, because there is a shameful lack of guidance on an acceptable amount of alcohol. It is a literal known carcinogen, and it significantly risks colorectal cancer. I am saying this as a person who does occasionally drink. I'm not one to be like, no, you cannot have your glass of wine. I have been very open about the moderation use of alcohol in populations that are fine with it. But to give literally no guidelines in the dietary guidelines for Americans just seems like a huge disservice for the population. And when asked about it, it was called a social lubricant. I'm sorry, I just don't think that's acceptable, but that's neither here nor there. But again, having distinct guidelines based in science is what this literal document is for. Now is not the time for ambiguity and just being like, yeah, man, you know, whatever feels right, just have less of it for better health. That doesn't give anybody any guidelines or rules to even kind of follow if they're trying to live a healthier lifestyle. And if you really want to get into it, when you take out quantitative limits, you really shoot yourself in the foot to be able to use these DGAs to support any real policies in nutritional policy. But that's a bigger conversation for later. Anyway, it also recommends, the DGAs also recommend using full fat dairy products instead of low fat products, which, listen, I think there are times and instances to use certain products. And I think in children, full fat dairy products for brain development, eye development, perfectly fine. I love that. I even have an episode on nutrition for fertility. And there's links between full fat dairy products and things like that. However, if you're someone going about your day and there's just a myriad of reasons why low fat could be a better option for someone else. So just having this overarching recommendation of use full fat is just, again, unclear to the major population. And just a side note, there is a notable absence of choosing pasteurized dairy products as like in past guidelines. However, I can just be very thankful they don't say to drink raw milk, which I think I should just be thankful that they didn't put that in there. But I think it's weird to take away the recommendation of choosing pasteurized items altogether. Next is the recommendation for saturated fats, and it should not exceed 10% of total daily calories. And I love that recommendation. I stand by that. I realize you want actually less than that for cardioprotective effects. The DGAs actually define healthy fats as those that are in meats, poultry, eggs, omega-3 rich seafoods, nuts, seeds, and full fat dairy, olives, and avocados. Love that. Don't have an issue with that. However, there's some contradictions in that little part. It says when cooking, you should use olive oil, which I recommend to a lot of my clients, butter, or of course, beef tallow. Now, I don't know about you guys, but if you just take a gander at the nutrition label on butter or beef tallow, it contains saturated fat. This part of the guidelines is kind of funny because it recommends prioritizing oils with essential fatty acids, and then they say such as olive oil, which I love olive oil, and like I said, I recommend it to a lot of people, but it is absolutely not a great source of essential fatty acids, which, just a reminder, are omega-6 and omega-3s. So according to the USDA's own website, it is less than 1% omega-3 and 8% omega-6s, whereas things like canola oil. Oh no, I'm saying canola oil. I'm talking about seed oils. Canola oil is 7.5% of omega-3s and 17.8 omega-6s. So I think ignoring the cardioprotective effects of seed oils like canola oil, I think it kind of, it just, again, it's unclear. I think they would have imploded if they said something about seed oils in the guidelines, but that I'm not doing a good job at hiding my personal opinions. Another concern is they recommend whole grains. That's not the concern. That's fine with me. And I love that. It says prioritize fiber-rich whole grains and significantly reduce the consumption of highly processed refined carbohydrates that displace real nourishment. Again, I don't have an issue with that, but in the FAQs, some foods that they list to fit that would be oats, rice, and true sourdough. Those are the preferred whole grains that they're recommending. True sourdough is literally made with refined grains, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, These are my top concerns, and I think we could have a very long episode if I touched on every single thing that I had an issue with, but I believe that could be true of any conversation and any topic, if that makes sense. People wanted to know what a registered dietitian initially thought of these new DGAs, and here I am delivering in a 20-minute mini episode that you can just pop in your ears and listen to while you walk your dog. Initially, when they were talking about releasing these new guidelines, I was worried, and I'll be the first to admit that, but honestly, I was worried they might say something bad or dangerous, but looking at this 10-page document meant for the general public, I'm not sure it says much of anything. There's a lot of ambiguity and unclear direction when the entire purpose is to be a guideline, and I just don't love that. Hey, is it job security for me? Absolutely it is. I mean, depending on what part you like really, really look at, you can conclude there's not much that has changed or things that have happened dramatically, but I think deeper conversations of access to whole foods and how that's a literal privilege, you know, just telling the general public to just eat real food, that ignores food deserts and rising groceries costs. And on the note of real food, whatever, and it's riddled if on the new website, realfood.gov, it is literally called real food. And you know that I'm a huge person who really leans into intentional vocabulary regarding food and nutrition, and saying real food over, I don't know, maybe whole food. I go back and forth in this in my head. So excuse me for just talking out my butt right now, but I just did not love the judgmental tone of you should just eat real food, because it does ignore an entire classification of people who do rely on processed foods because that is what's accessible to them, and the people who are in food deserts and things like that. So, but I think that's my job as a nutritional professional to convey that. But I just didn't love the wording behind it, but it very much is catchy and it hits home with a lot of people and they love it. So I understand why they chose it. Don't love it, but that's, again, another personal opinion. I think the biggest takeaway from these new DGAs is nutrition is not one size fits all. I have said that from day one. People, kids, athletes, older adults, people with diabetes, people with chronic conditions, you name it, they all have different needs. Every single person has different needs. And these guidelines are they're unclear. And it's a 10-page document, whereas the previous 2020 guidelines were like 160 pages. So it's not as deep. I do believe more Americans will read it because it is so short, but I don't know if that's good or bad. I'm still deciding. But the good thing is, if you're a health professional and you're, you know, on the more worried side of these guidelines, the good thing is a lot of people are uncompliant. They're uncompliant. And a lot of people actually don't really pay much attention to the dietary guidelines. Who they listen to a lot of the times are people on social media, and that is why I encourage people to follow actual nutrition educators, people, registered dietitians, some doctors, not all of them, but some doctors who consult dietitians, and why you need to be wary of where you receive your information. I think these guidelines, they're not bad. They're not awesome, but they're not bad. And I think if you take them at face value, cool, let's eat more fruits and veggies. Let's eat some whole grains. I didn't even touch on the protein. I touched on protein, but I didn't talk about the protein sources. I'll quickly do that because I can't not scratch an itch. I if you quickly look at the upside down food pyramid, it looks like you should be eating a huge steak all the time because it's at the top. It's very loud. It very minimizes plant protein sources, and I don't love that. And if you consume a whole bunch of red meat, that's going to up your intake of sodium and saturated fats. And I think that should also be considered too when you are looking at these overarching guidelines. Oh, another scratch that I can't itch. Oh, this is such a poorly constructed like audio message, but you know what? That this is, it literally just dropped. So, I mean, I'm very impressed with myself that I'm getting this out here today. So anyway, another scratch that I can't itch is artificial sweeteners are perfectly fine and can be used as a good tool for people who are in a calorie deficit for whatever reason they may be in. I did not love the guideline of just limiting them and avoiding them altogether. Same with artificial dyes. It's like rearranging the chairs on a Titanic, as I had heard in a recent interview. It's literally a non-issue at this point in day of age. But you know what? It's fine. I don't, with the ambiguity of these dietary guidelines, again, you can't really use it as fuel to the fire for policy change. So I guess that's good in that aspect regarding, you know, artificial sweeteners and things alike. If you've stuck around this long, I really appreciate you giving this a listen. I really actually don't intend on re-upping this podcast anytime soon because, you know, things, life happens, job changes, things like that. But I did want to get out my thoughts because I think it's important, again, as a nutrition communicator, that I needed to have it solidified. And if someone says, hey, what are your thoughts on these new guidelines? I can point them in the direction of this and they can send it to whomever they want and use it as a tool. I appreciate you guys. The guidelines are, they're not that bad as I thought they would be, but they're not as good as I would hope they would be. And I think that really sums up my thoughts.